You're still in Howltown, aren't you? He pulled from his pocket a mirror and held it under her nose. Looking from her eyes to the glass, he counted. The mirror fogged up at second 22. Still alive, he said. Still in that dark city of your own. He pocketed the mirror. I wonder, Carol, how difficult it was for you to reach a sitting position. I wonder what I look like to you right now. He smiled for her, snapped his teeth. You've never moved before. Why now? Why now, indeed? Why now, when Dwight needed less stress than ever? He placed a fingertip against her chest. He pushed. Carol fell back to the coach's floor, but her fingernail scratched Dwight's face on the way. Hey! Dwight brought a hand to his cheek and saw, yes, a thin trickle of blood. They're gonna know. It's a sign of a struggle. They're gonna know! Stop it! His voice, chastising himself, echoed across the open trail. He stared at Carol then, flat upon her back in the coach. He imagined Opal asking to check the coach once more, one more time, only to find Carol sitting up as Dwight had seen her. How? How had it happened? What had changed so that Carol could move? It's not fair, he said, kneeling in the dirt by the trail's edge. He grabbed handfuls of earth and rock. You never moved before. It's not... He rose and went to the coach. Fair! Then Dwight shoved the stony dirt up Carol's dress, stuffing it by her waist. He went back to the trail's edge and took some more. This he shoved down the dress's neckline, jamming it under her shoulders. He got some more. He stuffed more of it into her dress. Try getting up now, he said. Try sitting up now! Dwight made many trips to the trail's edge, bringing more and more earth to the coach. By the time he was done, satisfied that Carol couldn't possibly rise with the weight he'd added to her dress, he adjusted the mirror so that it reflected the coach, the same way Opal had seen it. On his quick walk to the driver's box, he thought it an irresistible image, Carol with rocks in her dress, as if she were drowning without water. He grabbed rope from the box, brought it to the coach door, and tied the door closed. This isn't fair! He echoed, his voice shaking enough that, had Opal heard it now, there would be more than suspicion in the lawman's eyes. It's unjust! Dwight climbed up into the driver's box and clacked the reins. The steeds erupted into motion. What, Martha dear? Who? Oh, why, that's the old friend we're burying tomorrow. That's the last thing we've got to do. He snapped the reins again. His voice, he thought, sounded like a child's, and it only scared him more. How would Carol Upright have looked to Manders, to Opal, to Moxie? He passed the big homes of Harrow's, passed even his own. Without realizing he'd made a change of plans, he was in the process of carrying them out. There was one place he needed to go before returning home, in the hope of removing one of the many faces that he still saw upon the head of the stranger he'd woken to. One stop, Martha. Trust me. He thought of Carol on her back, rocks and dirt in her dress. But you always do trust me, don't you? Yes, you do. He touched the new cut on his face. Where to? Where are we going? Why, her name is Farrah Darrow, and she needs to be reminded who she works for. Dwight cried out into the coming night as blood trickled a thin line across his face, as the steeds crushed pebbles on the rocky trail, and as his wife, weighed down, did not move with the motion of the coach. Smoke passes old acquaintances on the chase. The four of them ate around the small table that greasy-bearded Gar said was more like a stool. They stuffed their faces with rabbit and drank beer that blonde Horace had ripped from the cold storage of the town's only tavern. It was evening, the sun had painted the sky the color purple, but there were no windows in the small wood shack, and all four of them liked it that way. Overweight Kent had shot the old man who owned the place. His body lay under a blanket outside, beside the hole they shit in. Lewis, the most stable-minded of the lot, was the cook. Tonight he turned the rabbit caught in the big woods, and the smoke went through a hole in the roof shot through by Kent, too. Horace stood watch, making sure the smoke or smell didn't bring any lawmen, but really he just sat on a stump and smoked a pipe himself. There were no beds in the dirty shack, no bedding. 4 days Horace had been putting off going into Albertsport to get any supplies. He claimed the law in Albertsport was ticky-tacky, and would pick a man up for looking confused. The men argued this topic often. Some were getting stir-crazy. Gar wanted to go into town. He growled about men's needs and said there was no reason to live like paupers. But Horace was very serious and even threatened once to turn the others in if anyone went. It was the trials of traveling with fellow outlaws.
"There's fur on this rabbit yet, Lewis," Gar said, taking a bite. "Skin's the best part," Kent answered.
In the corner of the shack, on the dirty wood floor, sat a box of gunpowder the four had stolen 2 weeks prior. The plan was to sprinkle the stuff in a line around Deputy Pearson's home, up near Aberystown, and watch the pig shitter explode. Pearson's men had been tailing the trigger men, and they were getting closer. But the powder made Gar nervous. He thought to himself, "Dead skulls like you three around, and I gotta worry you're gonna drop your smoke right into the box."
"We're gonna need ourselves more beer soon," Kent said, rubbing his belly. "How is it we run out so quick?"
This would pose a real problem and could possibly break the stalemate regarding going into town. Gar's plan was to clean himself up nice with a shave, or to clean Lewis up since he, despite his age, was the baby face, and send him in as a traveler, someone there to spend his coin. Gar had known tough lawmen in his time, and raged at horses hyperbolizing the ones in Albertsport.
"Looks like we'll have to go into town for more,"
Gar said, looking directly at Horace as he tore meat from the rabbit bones. Horace knew he had to say something.
"We can go without for a night or so, Gar. We'll steal some on the other side of town."
Gar scowled.
"You might do whatever you like, good man. I might do the same."
The wet sound of the men sucking meat from the bone padded the silence between them.
"We done already had this talk, Gar."
"Yes, many times."
"Many times."
Lewis rose, went to a bucket, and brought back some more rabbit.
"No end to the meat, though," Gar said. "Got plenty of first-rate meat."
"Pipe it, Gar,"
Kent said suddenly, grabbing hold of the charred rabbit and tearing a good piece from its neck. Gar stood up quick and took Kent by the collar.
"You don't tell me to pipe anything, understand?"
Horace and Lewis froze. Gar was something like his own big fear. The gunpowder, all ready to explode, just needed a small spark.
"All right, Gar."
"Don't tell me all right."
"Okay."
Gar let go and sat back down, crashing upon the chair.
"The last time I listened to you three, we let a man go we ought to have killed. Had him for dead. Had his whole body there before us, and walked away with only his legs."
Horace stared coldly at Gar. Lewis rose and pretended to be minding the meat bucket.
"That's right," Gar said, his mouth full of rabbit. "I'll be listening to myself from now on, and I'm fixing to go into town to get me some things."
The tension was high.
"Y'all smell that?"
Lewis suddenly asked, standing by the bucket near the wall. He stuck his nose out.
"And I'll tell you what I'll get when I'm there,"
Gar went on, ignoring the cook.
"I'm gonna get a damn pillow, a bottle of booze, some fine pig I can suck on for as long as I want. I'm gonna get a quilt, too. That's right, I am."
"Fellas,"
Lewis said, stepping from beside the bucket and placing his fingertips against the wall. "Boys?"
"A whole rack of lamb is what I'm gonna get, and a good horse, too. I'll find myself the best feed they got, and fatten up that horse and ride the beast right out from under their noses, I will."
"You boys smell that?"
Lewis asked again. Now Gar turned to Horace.
"And whence I do, noble Horace, I'll be sure to send ye a gift box. A box full of rabbit, stale beer, and pig shit."
Gar cocked his head back and howled delight. Lewis was at the table now.
You boys smell that?
Gar stopped laughing.
Smell what, Lewis?
Horace asked.
Come here.
The other three got up, and Lewis held out both palms for them to stop moving.
No, wait. You can smell it right here.
The men were quiet, their noses in the air.
All I smell is burnt rabbit, Gar said, and dirty floors.
No,
Horace said, holding up a hand.
Smells like oil.
Gar scowled.
Now how in hell's heaven could it smell like oil? I know I weren't lucky when I met you louses, and I know we aren't sitting on any oil.
It is oil,
Horace said. A sudden boom from outside, and the wood walls began crackling. Gar grabbed his guns. Horace ran to the door and kicked it open. Flames rushed in fast, taking Horace by the shirt and hair. He fell to his knees, screaming, unable to put it out.
It's the law!
Lewis screamed.
The powder!
Gar yelled.
The powder!
Horace was rolling on the wood floor, burning. Kent stepped to the door, an arm protecting his face, and looked into the flames. It was a path of fire, a tunnel of flames, chest high, blocking the only way out. The roof was seconds from catching.
Someone's out there!
Kent screamed and shot into the fire. Lewis was beside him now, shooting too. The roof caught. Gar dropped to his knees and dragged the box of gunpowder to the center of the shack. He covered it with his arms, his wild eyes scanning the corners where the walls met the floor.
There's someone out there!
Kent called again, trying to shy the flame from his face. Kent was right. There was someone out there. Someone they once ran with. Someone they changed forever. Smoke saw the faces of the men turn black with ash, men who once stood above him as he woke in an alley, as rain crashed crazy to the earth and did not wash the blood from his severed legs, but spread it wide instead. A growing pool of blood at his knees that flowed toward his shoulders with a slight sloping of the ground. Smoke couldn't see them then, couldn't see their faces, just four black ovals appearing and disappearing behind the thick columns of falling water.
Sorry we had to cut you up, fella,
Gar said then, the rusted axe still in hand.
But corn is tight, and a four-way split is something better than a five.
Smoke didn't yet know what they had done to him.
And I'll tell you what else,
Gar hissed.
I never liked you none, and you know it. Too unruly for your own good. Too loud. Men who have secrets don't like loud.
Smoke couldn't hear him or the others as they called out through the rain that night. He knew something terrible had happened to himself, something like being mangled now, deformed. Things had gone wrong. The world they ran in was ugly, angry, and smelled like pig piss, and yet well within the lawlessness of that daily life, something had gone terribly wrong. Smoke felt the blood pooling by his head then. He could smell it. Gar's axe reflected the moonlight, and Smoke's hands went to his head first. He groped his chest, his waist, his groin, looking for the reason for that axe.
Try getting up, pig shitter. Try getting up.
Smoke felt his thighs and knew it before he got to his knees. Yes, things had gone wrong. He looked about the alley, frantic. The rain fell chittering from the black sky.
I done warned thee,
Gar called.
I done told you I'd chop you up if you didn't settle down.
Then Gar dropped to his knees and whispered close in Smoke's ear.
Try getting up, pig shitter. Try getting up.
Smoke saw them then, his lower legs, 2 yards from his body, beyond the boots of the others. The smell of horror and beer and Gar's bestial odor overcame him, and he vomited. It came up fast and hung on his chin and neck. And the rain did not wash this away either. Gar hadn't just severed his lower legs. He'd sliced him at the center of his knees.
Oh, lucky! Gar hollered, rising. The pig shitter shit out his face!
Smoke heard their voices leaving him then, boots on wet earth fading, smothered by the volume of the rain. He saw the moonlight glisten once off the axe Gar carried. Smoke, insane, screamed,
"My legs! Leave my legs! You can't have my legs!"
He passed out that way, with the mad idea that he just needed to reach his lower legs. If he could just get to them, then he'd be able to connect them, simple, back onto his body. But when he woke, the reality of it woke with him. If he was going to walk again, if he was going to catch the man who hurt him, Smoke was going to need new legs. Now, standing at the head of a path of flames, he watched, vengeful, motionless, mad. Soon the gunshots ceased. James Moxie was gaining ground, but Smoke wasn't thinking of the legendary outlaw at all.
"I got better legs, boys. I got better."
He had. When Smoke woke again, everything the same, the rain, the darkness, the blood, he started crawling for help. Someone passed the entrance to the alley and looked inside. There he saw Smoke, dragging his partial body by his fingertips along the rocky wet earth, blood flowing from his knees like oil. Smoke screamed for help. Black rainwater filled his mouth.
"A doctor! I need a doctor! Take me to a doctor!"
Now the memory of that doctor cauterizing his split knees was just one of a thousand crude paintings, none of them any good. But tonight, some of those paintings, those nightmares, had life to them. Art. Smoke did not smile. Smoke stood. These legs were better legs indeed. He watched as the lean-to lit up the early evening sky. A crown of thick flaming hair, moon-orange snakes fighting over the scurrying rats beneath them. The right wall caved in first. An astonishing splintering of wood that did not echo, but played out once, quick and flat. Howls for help erupted from within. Someone was still alive, begging to be let out. But there was no getting out. The door was a perfect coffin of red, raging arms. Smoke saw a figure inside, tearing at his own shirt, ripping off the buttons. Then the left wall fell, and with it, the roof. Smoke's eyes watered. It was magnificent. It was art. He just hoped the pig shitters didn't pass out before burning.
"Moxie, Moxie, Moxie, Maine."
He watched a while longer, but he had somewhere else to be, and he wasn't interested in seeing their bones. Their bones meant the suffering was over. He took with him the sight of Horace tearing at his shirt, his cheeks already blue with burn. He limped to his horse, hitched to a tree on the trail. Behind him, he heard an explosion, a little something extra going up in the shack, and still Smoke did not smile. Rather, he recalled the four faces looking down at him in the alley. He recalled the blood, the stink, the fear. Smoke did not look back.
"Moxie, Moxie, Moxie, Maine," he said without singing. "I once crawled legless through the rain."
The horse began trotting, Smoke back on the chase.
"Moxie, Moxie, Moxie, Matt."
The darkness, the wind, the trail.
"You can't get away from a man like that."
His horse, stronger than Old Girl, gained ground with every step, as if the legendary outlaw were slowing down without noticing, without seeing it, without knowing why. Farrah and Dwight.
"I'll tell you why I'm not going to that funeral, whether he's invited people or not."
Farrah was holding the bottle of whiskey she'd been carrying when Sheriff Opal stopped her on the boardwalk. Clyde lifted his glass without speaking, and she poured him some more without looking. Clyde had been worried about her all day. This morning, when they woke, he'd asked innocently if she'd like him to accompany her to the funeral. Farrah looked at him like she might hit him. Clyde didn't mention it again. He rose, got dressed, and left the house for work. When he returned, Farrah was opening that bottle of whiskey, and she said,
"I saw you coming up the road. Thank hell's heaven it was you."
At first, Clyde didn't want to share the bottle with her. He'd had a full day of working, and working off his own drinking, helping to reinforce the wooden beams of Harrow's one theater, the Northern. More than that, he didn't know if Farah should be drinking so much so fast. And yet they were a quarter of the way into the bottle when she told him she'd talked with Sheriff Opal about Carol and Dwight Evers. But there was more. Clyde knew. Something else had happened, too.
"The man's up to no good,"
she told him. Then she looked over her shoulder to the window, and Clyde looked over her shoulder, too, before looking her back in the eye.
"What is it, Farah?"
Farah frowned and poured more whiskey. Clyde thought it just about the saddest, most lovely face he'd ever seen. Farah rose and went to the front door. She tried the handle, making sure it was locked. Then she stepped to the window and peered out the drapes. Clyde watched her in wonder.
"I'll tell you why I'm not going to that funeral, Clyde."
Suddenly, for the first time all day, there was some life in her eyes. Clyde liked to see this, but he had a bad feeling about the story she was about to tell him. Sometimes, Clyde knew, the life in someone's eyes was fear.
"When I came back from talking with Sheriff Opal, I set this bottle on the counter, and I went into the bedroom and lay down for a spell. I didn't sleep. I don't think I slept. I stared at the ceiling and thought about what I told the sheriff, and whether or not I told him enough or enough of the right things. I started to feel like I'd done something wrong. What if Mr. Evers is actually just a grieving man? I might have suggested something really awful then. No, if that's the case, if Mr. Evers is truly grieving, then I did do that. Even worse than that, I stood on a dirt road right there in the middle of all of Harrow's and told the sheriff I thought Mr. Evers might have played a part in Carol's death. And what does that mean? Clyde, what else could it mean? It means I suggested he killed her."
Farah looked beyond Clyde then to the window in the kitchen. She walked quickly past him and peered outside once more. It was dark out. In the glass, she saw only the kitchen reflected, Clyde at the table.
You don't really think that, do you, Farah?"
Farah turned to him quick, her face pale from the whiskey. Her eyes looked crazy.
"He was here, Clyde. I heard him outside. Then I heard him inside."
Clyde, stunned, looked over his shoulder to the front door.
"At first, I thought it was an animal,"
Farah said.
"I was in bed, lost in replaying that terrible conversation I'd had with Sheriff Opal, when the sound of footsteps on the grass came through the open bedroom window. I told myself it was a deer, a fox, something. You would have done the same. But it sounded heavier than any of those, and suddenly there was a shape in front of the window, blocking the sun. A black shadow came across me and across the bed, and I just about screamed. Someone was there. Someone was right there at the window, looking in."
Farah slumped into the other kitchen chair and sipped from her glass. Clyde thought about stopping her, telling her maybe she shouldn't drink so much right now. Had she been drinking when she saw someone outside the window?
"I pulled the blanket up to my eyes and stared at that shape at the window. No, I couldn't see a face. A black silhouette is what it was. I imagined any second he might break the glass, reach right in. What was he looking for? Who? Well, just as suddenly as he came, he was gone. And just as suddenly, someone opened the front door."
Clyde stood up now. He walked to the front door and checked the lock.
"Shutters, Farah," he whispered. "You're scaring me."
"I heard footsteps in the house, and I slipped quiet out of bed. I got on the ground and looked through the crack under the bedroom door, but I couldn't see anyone. I know our house is small, Clyde. I know it's just these few rooms, but he wasn't in sight. I got so scared I crawled right under the bed. You might have done the same thing. I crawled under the bed and held my hands and little fists up by my face. I listened to those footsteps, and they were slow, Clyde, like the man didn't want you or me to hear he was inside the house. And then he said my name."
Clyde's face was as white as hers now. He took hold of his glass and downed what was left, and then held it out. Farah refilled it.
"What next, Farah?"
Farah stared into the emptiness of the rest of the house before answering.
"Still under the bed. I looked toward the crack under the bedroom door, and the footsteps got closer. He called my name again. He said, "Farah, if you're here, I'd like to talk with you. It has to do with Carol. Maybe you can help." "On my blood, Clyde, on my blood."
She drank. She went on.
"The bedroom door opened slowly. I saw black shoes at the threshold. I tried not to breathe. He said my name again, and I started crying. But I didn't whimper, didn't make a sound, even when he stepped into the room and knelt beside the bed. Yes, Clyde, Mr. Evers knelt by our bed. I heard his knees touch the wood. I saw his black pants, a pair of pants I've seen 1,000 times hanging in a closet in that house of theirs. He knelt beside the bed and looked underneath it. Oh, bless the Lord, in hell's heaven, Clyde, I saw his face. He had a scratch on one cheek, and he stared under the bed a long time in silence, and then suddenly whispered my name, and then I almost did whimper. I almost screamed. Farah, he didn't see me. Bless the time of day, he didn't see me. He rose again. He got up, and he left.
Clyde got up, too, and went to her. He put his hand on her shoulder, and she cried, full and honest. Then he stepped to the lantern and blew it out. In the dark, he walked to the window and looked outside for a long time. Farah was quiet. Clyde walked through the house, checking the other windows, the closets, under the bed. In the darkness, he said,
"You have to tell Sheriff Opal about this. It don't matter how scared you are, Farah."
"I'm not going out there tonight, Clyde, and I'm not going to that funeral. Do you understand me? I'm not going near that man."
Clyde nodded in the dark, but Farah did not see him.
"I'll go when it's over. The moment it ends, I'll pay my respects on my own. But I'm not going near that man."
Clyde heard her sip from her glass in the dark.
"Do you want some more, Clyde?"
He stepped through the house toward her.
"I surely do."
The clock on the mantel. What if she were to wake, right now? What if she were to come stumbling through the front door, her hand to her head, complaining of body aches, fatigue, and the things she'd heard within? Oh, the image of Carol in the foyer, the black night beyond her, seen through the open front door. Her hair blown wild by that dark wind, 1,000 buried screams, the blubbering of banshees she was so close to meeting, so close to sharing her story with, the story of her husband, and how he tried very hard to bury her alive. Dwight loosened his tie. An owl spoke outside the parlor window, and he jumped and turned to the glass, half expecting to see Carol on the lawn, her comatose eyes open, her hands reaching for him still. But Carol slept, weighed down by earth and rocks, on the floor of the black coach in the drive. And yet, what if she were to wake, right now? Hadn't she woken in less time before? And she'd never sat up before, never moved. Dwight sat down on the edge of the couch. The clock on the mantel sounded flatly in the plush, cushioned room. Seconds ticked. How many more? 30,000 more? Too many. More than enough time. Dwight rose from the couch and wiped sweat from his forehead. A few minutes passed before he understood he'd been staring at a throw pillow, fantasizing about smothering his sleeping wife with it. Another bestial sound from outside. Looking through the glass, he was certain he'd see Carol crawling out of the coach. "Dwight," she might say. "Dwight, I'm awake now. I'm awake." He went to the window and put his hands to the glass, shielding the reflected lanterns of the parlor. The coach door was still closed. But what if she were to wake right now? There was no good reason to believe she wouldn't, that she couldn't. And what would Dwight do then? Shoot her? Smother her? Drown her in the tub? She would go to Opal first. She must. And Opal would listen and console her while loading his gun and taking from his desk the key to one of the cells in the station. Opal would come for him. Maybe he was already on his way. James Moxie is on his way. Dwight ran a shaky hand through his damp, sweaty hair. What a cruel, unfair disadvantage for Carol to have known one of the trail's most legendary outlaws, It wasn't right, he felt, to have to worry about this man, this monster, approaching, splitting midnight on a black horse, coming to break open the wood coffin with his bare, mythic hands.
"Oh," he said, his voice like a child's, "what if she were to wake right now?"
Dwight would hide. Yes, if he heard the creaking of the coach door opening, he would rush to the pantry in the kitchen and hide. The clock on the mantel ticked. Dwight paced the parlor. The lantern sent shadows up and down the beautiful room, a room decorated and funded entirely by Carol. Each shadow imitated the posture of his sleeping wife, now standing in the doorway, a thousand vengeful spirits beside her, those she met when so close to death, the friends she'd made in Howltown. "Kill her now," he thought. He looked down to see he had the throw pillow in his hands. His knuckles were white with squeezing. Yet another sound from beyond the glass, and this time Dwight froze. The pillow fell to his feet, and he was certain, yes, he heard footsteps. Leaves on the lawn crunching beneath the weight of something much greater than a squirrel, a bunny, a fox. Unthinking, his shoes shuffled backward to where the lantern did not reach, to the corner of the parlor, where just yesterday women whispered about the sad sudden passing of Carol Evers. He did not take his eyes from the glass, though he wanted to very badly. Dwight whimpered, a single girlish hiccup, before seeing the shape of a deer pass ghost-like across the frame. Pig shit on Robert Manders and his line of dead bodies. Curse the illness that had come to Harrow's, that had granted Carol these remaining 30,000 seconds to wake. The clock on the mantel clucked, and Dwight stepped to it fast and took hold of it and smashed it against the brick framing of the fireplace.
"Stop it!"
he screamed.
"Stop it now!"
Oh, if Dwight used his hands, Opal would find the marks of murder upon her.
"No marks,"
he said. Then he brought a finger to the slight cut on his face, made by Carol in the coma. What if she woke, right?
"You heard wrong, Carol. Dear, what you heard in there was not true. It was a nasty dream, nothing more. Distortion, perversion, a nasty dream."
He brought a hand to his chest. He was breathing much too hard. So much planning, such good plans. All of them, for naught, if she were to wake. Right now. Light sparkled outside, and Dwight was certain it came from within the coach. The door was opening, and his conscious bride was coming to life in some hellish form of light. She would come with the face of the grave upon her, the future dirt and death smell, the way he wanted her to be. But awake, alive. Yes, Carol would come with string-thin hair and black oil nails, and Dwight would cower, chattering as she approached, her voice level fury, telling him,
"They all know, they all know, they all know, Dwight, that you tried to bury your wife alive, because they all know you couldn't bear the burden of her shadow, her mind, her money. They all know, they all know, they all know you didn't have the guts to kill her. They all know you waited, waited, waited for her to do it herself, for you. Even this you couldn't do on your own."
A sound outside, and Dwight cried out,
"Stay away, James Moxie! Stay away!"
Not just any outlaw, no, no. The outlaw who killed a man without drawing his gun. The Black Magic Marvel, a name bigger than any other on the trail. A trail littered with the tracks of 1,000 terrible men. And he, the biggest, the darkest, the worst, was coming. Coming! Coming here. What if she were to wake right now? Light dazzled through the glass, and Dwight curled up into the corner. He shook his head, no, no, and knew it was James Moxie, knew it was Sheriff Opal, knew it was Carol herself. The clock, smashed and in pieces on the floor, clucked the seconds away. Someone was coming. The light, a lantern. Someone was coming up the drive. Dwight shook his head, no, no, and the fingers of fear held him flat against the wall. Who could it be? Who would come calling at this late hour if not with a mind for murder? The light grew, and Dwight saw the orb pass close to the coach. Was Carol sitting up in there? Could the carrier of the light see her body within? The light vanished from view, A knock came at the door. I was sleeping, Sheriff Opal. I didn't hear your knock. I was sleeping, Sheriff Opal. I didn't hear your knock. I was sleeping. Hello? A foreign voice, a voice Dwight did not know. Timid, trembling, he stepped from the corner of the parlor, and his boots clacked against the wood floor, and the echo told the person at the door that he was indeed not sleeping.
Hello? Is there someone there?
Dwight crossed the room slowly, his teeth clenched painfully, his eyes wet and wide, his fingers contorted into claws.
Hello?
Dwight opened the door. In the light of the held lantern, the traveler saw him, and saw that he was the picture of unbalance, that he had perhaps knocked on the wrong door tonight.
I'm sorry to have bothered you, sir, but I was looking for a place to sleep. I've been walking some...
What? The traveler inched back from the door.
I don't mean to bother you, kind sir. I'll just...
What are you saying?
Sir?
What are you doing here? The traveler attempted to plead ignorance once more. Dwight shut the door. And he stood by the window, watching the orb of light grow smaller once again. As the stranger passed the coach in the drive, Dwight did not gasp. He did not cry out. For he almost expected she would be sitting up in there, her and the thousand spirits she had met so close to death.
They all know, they all know, they all know!
Lafayette! Dwight said, and his voice was animal instinct. His voice was hardly his own.
Call Lafayette, once more. Get rid of the girl Farrah. Farrah knows something. Get rid of the girl. What if she says something? What if she says my name? What if she says...
Carol. What if she says Carol is only sleeping? And what if Carol were to wake up from that sleep right now? Carol and Rot. Rot held her hand. Carol saw it in the glass, saw what looked like a hand made of cowhide gripping her own. She understood, instinctively, that the veil between the real world, the world in which she slept, and this one, had slimmed. She also knew it was the doing of the monster that sat beside her on the coach floor. He leaned close and whispered,
"Look, Carol, out the coach window. Do you see that cardinal rise to the sky?"
Carol did see it, and while the terror she felt for being so close to Rot ruled her, she couldn't help but experience the astonishment, still, for seeing anything of the real world while still inside the coma. But Rot had given her light, light to see by, light to see her own end by. "That," he whispered, and his breath was meat left out in the yard.
"That is how things really look. That is how all things will end."
Carol understood, for while she could see the bird rising in the sky, it did not resemble the healthy cardinals she'd counted in her gardens at home. Rather, the bird seemed made of red paper, paper left in the puddle of oil, feathers shining wet with the means by which it could suddenly go up in flames. Beside her, Rot wheezed and held her hand, as Carol tried hard not to look at him in the glass, tried hard not to see the bird either, the rotting thing flying, rising into the sky, believing itself still alive, not aware how much it had already died. But Carol had little trouble resisting the urge to move now. Dwight had seen to that, and somehow, to her, this was the most terrible thing Dwight had done. Worse, it seemed, even than trying to kill her. By loading her dress with rocks and earth, Dwight had made it impossible again for her to move in Howltown, a thing she had tried her whole life to do.
"There's the difference between bad and evil," John Bowie once told her, his voice slurred with brandy. "Bad is when you ignore the one you love, but evil is when you know exactly what that person wants, what means most to them, and you figure out how to take it away."
Moxie. Moxie believed he was going to make it to Harrow's by nightfall, because if he didn't believe that, he'd go mad. He'd make it. He'd sleep in the graveyard at the lip of the hole dug for Carol.
And when the diggers came and asked him to leave, he'd bury them instead. He'd bury the whole town if he had to. If it meant burying whoever had hired the cripple, whoever wanted to stop him from breaking apart the funeral of a living woman. Carol wasn't going into the ground, not tomorrow. It's her husband. Because it had to be. Because only husbands and wives could be so cruel. The guilt had galvanized, become a solid mass within him, or rather, had taken the place of his blood, flowed through his veins like oil, slick and sludged. The husband wouldn't be the husband if Moxie hadn't run away. The husband hired the cripple. The man of the house certainly read the incoming telegrams. He knew Moxie was coming. He knew Moxie knew about Carol. He wanted Carol dead. But why? A figure emerged from the brush ahead, and Moxie did not hesitate in bringing forth his gun. The man stumbled, and Rinaldo's description of a crippled hitman came scorching a flame to the foreground of Moxie's mind before he understood the man had only been drinking. Close call. Near death for the drunk.
"Hey there, feller!"
Old girl continued, and Moxie did not respond.
"Hey there! Hold up now! Stop for a minute, why don't you?"
The man stumbled against the trunk of an enormous oak, then stumbled back onto the trail. Moxie and old girl were beside him now, and the man looked up, unnecessarily shielding his eyes from a sun that was long tucked away for the night. Later, the man's wife wouldn't believe him. She'd tell him he was drunk and leave him stewing in the kitchen. But ultimately, he would know that it was true. That when he looked up at the man on the mare, the man looked down at him, and the man looked like he had no face, like the only features he had were guilt and rage, and both were wrapped like gauze tied tight to his fiery skull.
"It's true!"
he would holler at his wife, his words slurred, his vision blurred.
"Truer than anything I've ever seen. His eyes burned, and his face was made of stone. He held his gun between my eyes. He did! And he said something I'll never forget. He said it like I knew what he was talking about, like we were in the middle of a conversation. He said, 'She's not going into the earth.' How was I to respond? Hell's heaven, I shivered and fell to my knees on the trail. Drunk or not, I saw the face of guilt out there. And I saw the rage it takes to atone for it."
Alexander Wolfe. Opal was sitting at his desk when the doctor walked in. He was well-dressed, and his full silver hair was combed back from his forehead, expressing confidence in the striking features of his face. A thick silver mustache highlighted his square chin, and Opal had a feeling he knew who it was before the man introduced himself. "I'm Dr. Alexander Wolfe." He had bright science in his eyes. "Are you the sheriff, then?"
"That I am."
"Care to talk? Do you mind if I sit down? I've driven all the way from Charles. My coachman is sick this evening, and I've had to make the trip alone." Opal extended a palm to the open chair on the other side of his desk. Outside, the sky was already close to black. If Opal opened the window at this hour, he would most likely hear some harmless variety of ne'er-do-well on the square. But tonight, the doctor from Charles had his entire attention.
"Mr. Evers sent me. His telegram was full of much concern. Seems he thinks you don't believe I exist."
"I'm still not sure I do."
Wolfe smiled.
"With all due respect, Sheriff, and I do mean respect, where I come from, that sounds like you may have it in for an innocent man."
"That's how they'd see it in Charles."
"That's how they'd see it just about anywhere, I'd gather."
When Wolfe smiled, his eyes flashed white. His skin tightened to his face.
"And why's that?"
"Why? Because I'm sitting before you is why."
"Any proof you're who you say you are? Any proof you're a doctor?"
"You may have to take my word for it, though we could talk medicine all night if you need to."
"Maybe I do."
"Very well. Tell me, how can I help my friend clear his good name with you?"
"You can tell me about Carol Evers."
"What do you want to know?"
"How'd she die?"
"It's not that easy, I'm afraid."
He tented his long, clean fingers above the crossed legs of his suit pants.
I think hers was a weak heart. Dwight told me she was known to complain of lightheadedness. I understand she experienced a bout of it the evening she passed.
I heard the same thing. Where'd you hear yours?
Dwight told me, of course. Who else? Opal did not respond. He stared hard into Wolf's bright eyes. Wolf said, "The man is grieving."
"Yes, that's what he told me."
"And you don't believe that, either?" Opal dropped his elbows to the desk and leaned forward.
"You're just a walking question machine, ain't you? You dispense questions like they're sugar treats. How about we reverse that lever, and you start answering instead?"
Wolf's expression did not change. "Yes, of course."
"What do you think she died of, Doctor? And why do you think what you think?"
Wolf breathed deep. "In my opinion, Carol Evers passed from a weak heart. I came to that conclusion based on the fact that she had poor circulation, a symptom of which could have been the dizzy spells. I suppose she could have had a stroke."
"You don't know?"
"No, Sheriff. If I had been her physician through life..."
"Why weren't you?"
Wolf appeared to be only mildly affected by the question.
"I'm not sure. Too far away, I suppose." "But close enough to call the evening she died."
"Death is a much more serious thing than the common cold, Sheriff Opal."
"Who's talking about the common cold?"
Wolf smiled. "I think what matters here is that she's passed. Your asking for me insinuates you're suspicious of Dwight."
"I'm suspicious of you."
"I understand that. We've never met before. Still, I'm not sure what else a man can do but tell you who he is. It's up to you to believe him or not."
"Why aren't you in the registry?"
A sudden question. Opal watched close for the reaction.
"Excuse me?" "The ledger of registered doctors."
"Because I'm not."
"Not registered?"
"That's right."
"How's that?"
"You understand more than most that a man has the right to see whatever variety of doctor he chooses, just like he votes as he wishes and eats as he likes. My methods aren't considered suitable by an archaic volume, and you, like those who compiled the book, think I don't exist for it."
"Are you a witch doctor?"
Wolf smiled. "No, but I believe the spirit can heal most wounds." Opal leaned back in his chair. This was the best answer he'd had to this question.
"So you're a quack," Opal said.
"Not a quack. A modernist, if you will." Opal tapped his fingertips on the desk.
"A modernist?"
"I think this is a classic case of a woman simply being taken too soon."
"You do?"
"Yes. Some deaths are ill-timed. All, I dare say."
"How do you feel about Evers keeping the body in the cellar?"
"I'm not sure what you mean."
"Just what I said."
Wolf considered. "I've known men and women to keep the deceased many places. It depends on what you plan on doing with the body."
"Well, most people deliver the body to the funeral director here in Harrow's. Most people would rather it wasn't in their own hands for very long."
"Isn't the funeral tomorrow morning?"
"Yes, it is."
"That doesn't sound unreasonable to me." Opal considered. When Wolf first entered the station, he thought it might be someone Dwight hired. Like everything else with Evers, it was too tidy. But the man was convincing. Wolf didn't know everything, a trait Opal looked for in a sincere person.
"Quite an illness hit Harrow's just 4 weeks back."
"Of course, I know of it. A deluge of rot."
"Pardon?"
"Many graves, Sheriff. Too many." Opal paused.
"You think it had anything to do with Mrs. Evers's death?"
Wolf considered. "Well, I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer, but I would say no. I really do believe it was her heart." Opal studied the doctor's face a moment before rising.
"Thank you," he said.
Wolf stood up as well and attempted to make small talk, summer weather, the view from Harper's Hill. But Opal wasn't biting, and Alexander Wolf took his leave. Opal watched the man climb up a stanup and guide a brown horse back up the road from which he'd come.
He watched until the carriage vanished into the shadows beyond the Northern Theater, beyond the ice and candy parlor, beyond the gunsmiths, too. When Cole came in to take over for Opal, the sheriff said there'd been a change of plans. He wanted Cole to ride out to Dwight Evers's place and thank him for delivering the doctor. He wanted Cole to take note of Evers's reaction to the thank you, write down what he saw. The deputy did as the sheriff asked. When he returned, he told Opal that Mr. Evers said not to worry, but he hoped things were cleared up. He also said Dwight looked bad, grieving bad. Opal frowned. Always so tidy, always so clean. Cole shrugged and said,
"That's what I saw."
What Cole didn't see was Dwight's face after the deputy left. Breathing heavy, paranoid, and sweating, Dwight tried desperately to figure out who would have done this for him. Who would have known to do it? In the mirror, Dwight looked skeletal, his lips far from his teeth, his eyes wide as divots in the trail. The scratch on his cheek had stopped bleeding, had become something of a solid purple line. Alexander Wolfe was an invention of Dwight's splintering mind. And yet, tonight, the figment walked. He talked. Dwight locked the front door. The man with the shifting face had woken him, told him to hide his wife. And now, Alexander Wolfe. Dwight laughed, a single high-pitched shriek. Then he brought his hands to his lips, as though it were possible to retrieve it, as if it were terrible luck to laugh now, so close to Carol's burial. He wanted to feel grateful. He wanted to thank the man, the thing that was helping him. Instead, he brought a hand to his heart and trembled, unable to take his eyes from the shadowed corners of his home. Yes, thank you, was what he wanted to say, but he mouthed the words, "What do I owe you?" instead. Smoke Doesn't Sleep catches up to Moxie.
Hey, Moxie, Moxie, Moximo, go to where the dreamers go. Moxie, Moxie, Moxie me, lay thee down and go to sleep.
As he sang, Smoke's legs were screaming. The hole in his upper shin cut into his skin, and the wound was getting worse. Moxie was in Harrow's by now. Smoke knew this.
Oh, Moxie, Moxie, Moxie mine, sweat drips heavy from the vine. Moxie, Moxie, Moxie mug, you're cornered like a common bug.
A match came to life between his fingers, and Smoke saw he'd reached the thick northernmost woods of the trail. Shades of great pines showed in the scant light. Beasts scurried in the brush. Smoke sang to them. Beyond the horse's head, he saw the tracks he'd been following for 2 days. Looked like the outlaw's horse was getting tired, as the hoofprints were closer together now. A second set of tracks, too. The same Smoke had seen all day. Small hooves. Quick steps. As if someone were riding a dog. Whoever it was, they weren't riding with Moxie, and Smoke relished the idea of a simple civilian, a messenger, an innocent caught in the crossfire. Fire. Smoke smiled, but his eyes remained cold white in the darkness. He thought of Moxie's myth, re-witnessing the conviction held by the small man in Griggsville he'd torched on the shitter. He started to laugh, but the pain cut him short. Beyond the drone of black hooves clacking, he could hear the outlaw's voice, the things the legend would say when Smoke caught up to him. It'd be straight from the book of cliché pleading, the words all the older outlaws used when the end was nigh. Words they learned back when phrases were hotter than burning oil. Take that, hermit. Had he shot more and talked less, Smoke would be dead. But the old outlaws loved the talk.
"I'll give you 5 seconds," Moxie would say. "You better be planning on dying today," he would say. "I hope you said your goodbyes."
Oh, the shibboleths of the trail. Smoke tucked his chin low and feigned a deep voice.
"Break a leg, hitman. On your knees. It's gonna be a short fight, cripple."
He snickered and brought his boot heels down on the horse. It felt good to laugh, even a snort, even as the tin dug into his mangled knee. both he and the horse propelled by the sting of sharp metal against flesh. The wind picked up, the beast moved fast, and Smoke felt the town approaching.
"You're gonna lose your arms, too, cripple!"
At last, real, full laughter. Smoke felt the cool, dark air pass over him, as if he were traveling through a wall of ghosts. The horse was moving fast, dangerously fast, but Smoke didn't care. The horse could fall, could step hard in a divot, break two legs, send Smoke into the brush. Smoke could lose his own legs, lose his oil, but hell's heaven. He could smell that shitter town and the nonsense legend that lurked there.
"You done lit your last fire, cripple. I'm gonna enjoy breaking the rest of those legs."
Tree branches scratched at his arms and chest. Rocks flew from the horse's hooves. Smoke was gaining. Moxie wasn't going any farther than the finish line.
"Ooh-hee! We run now!"
He brought his shins down hard and felt the slosh within. Some spilled. Smoke didn't care. Not tonight. Tonight he could finish the outlaw with one drop. That was all he'd need. One drop of oil in Moxie's mouth. One drop of oil in his eye. Smoke felt it coming. The moment. The kill. The burn. They were past the pines now, and the moon lit up the fields beyond them. Smoke knew these fields were the last landmark he'd see before crossing the town's dotted line. Ahead, bathed in moonlight, he saw the town's outline, Harrow's silhouette, the downtown boardwalk and shops nestled at the base of a hill that boasted the finer homes and barns. Far to the right burned the many lanterns that framed the graveyard, making it look something like a ship to Smoke now, tombstones and markers out to sea, bobbing in the blackness. Smoke imagined. Smoke prepared. He was going to stand over Moxie and watch the flesh crinkle from his face, curl back black from his hairline and ears. The outlaw's mouth would open with fright, his last scream for life, his forever howl. He'd like to see Moxie bring his hands to the flames on his face. Oh, what glory to know Moxie's brain would burn inside his mythic skull, for inside that brain was the explanation for the trick at Aberystown, and once it was burnt, it was gone, and once it was gone, it was nothing, no more. No legend, no more. Smoke was going to watch the horse burn, too. Count on that. He'd been staring at the hoofprints forever. He'd start with the horse. The outlaw would hear the beast screaming and leap from the horse bed he shared. He'd rush half-naked out onto the balcony and see the good horse jerking its head from the hitching post, rendered ash and bone in the road. Had the great James Moxie ever heard the sound a horse makes as it burns? He would. Then he would know it had begun, that the man following him was now the man who had caught up, and the fire that made the mare scream was the very one coming for him.
"Moxie, Moxie, Moxie, my, we can't both get out of this alive."
Passing the dark, low fields just south of Harrow's, Smoke saw a scarecrow that reminded him, in shape, of his mother. Inspired by it, he imagined her burning. He imagined the dresses from her closet, the curls in her blonde hair, the rims of her glasses, all of it and everything blistering, bending, burning. The fire he imagined for her was blue and smelled like childhood. And childhood reminded him of the children he once knew. He imagined a girl named Merrily, melted to the shape of a chair, another, Henry, sitting upon her in a classroom. He'd like to burn them all. Every face he'd ever seen. Excited now, Smoke saw the mothers of these former schoolmates rushing from their homes, desperate feet pattering on the porch boards, able to discern the smell of their own child burning above all others. Smoke would be there when they came. He'd be there with a piece of meat on a stick. Dinner over childhood's fire.
"Hey, Ma! This meat only gets better the longer it cooks!"
Moved, Smoke imagined more. Men in suits bursting into flame upon exiting church. Families sitting down to eat burnt food, blackened bread, ashen meals upon scalding hot plates.
"Come on, Billy. Eat your fire. Eat your fire!"
A blazing funeral. A funeral in flames. Shitty Benson caskets lowered into blackened holes. A graveyard of open lids. Men and women screaming, "Help us!" covered in oil, drenched in dread. Heat thunder breaking open a midnight sky. And smoke,